Flashman at the Charge by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. The courier was evidently in no hurry, for we crawled along at an abominably slow pace, although telegrees can travel at a tremendous clip when they want to, with a bell clanging in front, and everyone scattering out of their way. It always puzzled me when I later saw the shocking condition of Russian roads, with their ruts and potholes, how the highways over which the telegrees travelled were always smooth and level. The secret was this. Telegrees were only used by couriers and officials of importance, and before they came to a stretch of road, every peasant in the area was turned out to sand and level it. So, as we lumbered along, the courier in state in the first telegree, and Flashy with his escort in the second, there were always peasants standing by the roadside, men and women in their belted smocks and ragged puttees, silent, unmoving, staring as we rolled by. This dull, brooding watchfulness got on my nerves, especially at the post stations, where they used to assemble in silent groups to stare at us. They were so different from the Krim Tatars I had seen, who are lively, tall, well-made men, even if their women are seedy. The steppe Russians were much smaller, and ape-like by comparison. Of course, what I didn't realize then was that these people were slaves, real bound European white slaves, which isn't easy to understand until you see it. This wasn't always so. It seems that Boris Godunov, whom most of you will know as a big fellow who takes about an hour and a half to die noisily in an opera, imposed serfdom on the Russian peasants, which meant that they became the property of the nobles and landowners, who could buy and sell them, hire them out, starve them, lash them, imprison them, take their goods, beasts and women folk whenever they choose. In fact, do anything short of maiming them permanently or killing them. They did those things too, of course, for I saw them, but it was officially unlawful. The serfs were just like the nigger slaves in the States. Worse off, if anything, for they didn't seem to realize they were slaves. They looked on themselves as being attached to the soil. "We belong to the master, but the land is ours," was a saying among them. And traditionally they had bits of land to work for their own benefit. 3 days on their patch each week, 3 on the master's, was supposed to be the rule. But wherever I went, it seemed to be 6 on the master's and 1 for themselves, if they were lucky. It may not seem possible to you that in Europe, just 40 years ago, white folk could be used like this, that they could be flogged with rods and whips up to 10 times a day, or knouted, which is something infinitely worse, or banished to Siberia for years at their landlord's whim. All he had to do was pay the cost of their transportation. They could be made to wear spiked collars, the women could be kept in harems, the men could be drafted off to the army so that the owners could steal their wives without embarrassment. Their children could be sold off, and in return for this they were meant to be grateful to their lords and literally crawl in front of them, calling them father, touching their heads on the ground and kissing their boots. I've watched them do it, just like political candidates at home. I've seen a lot of human sorrow and misery in my time, but the lot of the Russian serf was the most appalling I've ever struck. Of course, it's all changed now. They freed the serfs in 61, just a few years after I was there. And now, I'm told, they're worse off than ever. Russia depended on slavery, you see, and when they freed them, they upset the balance, and there was tremendous starvation, and the economy went to blazes. Well, in the old days, the landlords had at least kept the serfs alive for their own benefit. But after emancipation, why should they? And it was all nonsense anyway. The Russians will always be slaves. So will most of the rest of mankind, of course, but it tends to be more obvious among the Ruskies. For one thing, they look so damned slavish. I remember the first time I really noticed serfs, the first day's drive out of Taganrog. It was at a little village post station where some official was thrashing a peasant. Don't know why. And this dull clown was just standing and letting himself be caned by a fellow half his size, hardly even wincing under the blows. There was a little crowd of serfs looking on, ugly, dirty-looking rascals in hairy blue smocks and rough trousers, with their women and a few ragged brats. And they were just watching, like cowed, stupid brutes. And when the little official finally broke his cane and kicked the peasant and screamed at him to be off, the fellow just lumbered away, with the others trailing after him. It was as though they had no feeling whatever. Oh, it was a cheery place, all right, this great empire of Russia, as I first saw it in the autumn of 54, a great ill-worked wilderness ruled by a small-landed aristocracy with their feet on the necks of a huge human animal population, with Cossack devils keeping order when required. It was a brutal, backward place, for the rulers were ever fearful of the serfs, and held back everything educational or progressive. Even the railway was discouraged, in case it should prove to be revolutionary. And with discontent everywhere, especially among those serfs who had managed to better themselves a little, and murmurings of revolt, the iron hand of government was pressing ever harder. The White Terror, as they called the secret police, were everywhere. The whole population was on their books, and everyone had to have his billet, his ticket to live. Without it, you were nobody, you did not exist. Even the nobility feared the police, and it was from a landlord that I heard the Russian saying about being in jail. Only there shall we sleep sound, for only there are we safe. The land we travelled through was a fit place for such people. Indeed, you have to see it to understand why they are what they are. I've seen big countries before, the American plains on the old wagon trails west of St. Louis, with the whispering grasses weaving away and away to the very edge of the world, or the Saskatchewan prairies in grasshopper time, dun and empty under the biggest sky on earth. But Russia is bigger. There's no sky, only empty space overhead, and no horizon, only a distant haze, and endless miles of sun-scorched rank grass and emptiness. A few miserable hamlets, each with its rickety church, only seem to emphasize the loneliness of that huge plain, imprisoning by its very emptiness. There are no hills for a man to climb into or to catch his imagination. Nowhere to go. No wonder it binds its people to it. It appalled me as we rolled along, with nothing to do but strain your eyes for the next village, soaked by the rain or sweating in the sun, or sometimes huddling against the first wintry gusts that swept the steppes. They seemed to have all weathers together, and all bad. For amusement, of course, you could try to determine which stink was more offensive, the garlic chewed by the driver, or the grease of his axles, or watch the shuttlecocks of the wind-witch plant being blown to and fro. I've known dreary, depressing journeys, but that was the limit. I'd sooner walk through Wales. The truth is, I was beginning to find Russia a frightening place, with its brooding, brutish people and countryside to match. One began to lose the sense of space and time. The only reliefs were provided by our halts at the way stations, poor, flea-ridden places with atrocious accommodation and worse food. You'd been able to get decent beef in the Crimea for a penny a pound, but here it was jay and borscht, which are cabbage soups, horse-meat porridge, and sweet flour tarts, which were the only palatable things available. That and their tea kept me alive. The tea is good, provided you can get caravan tea, which is Chinese, and the best. The wine they may put back in the moujiks, for me. Moujiks are peasants. So my spirits continued to droop, but what shook them worst was an incident on the last morning of our journey when we'd halted at a large village, only 30 versts, 20 miles, from Staratorsk, the estate to which I was being sent. It wasn't so different, really, from the peasant thrashing I'd already seen. Yet it and the man involved branded on my mind the knowledge of what a fearful, barbarous, sickeningly cruel land this Russia was. The village lay on what seemed to be an important crossroads. There was a river, I remember, and a military camp, and uniforms coming and going from the municipal building where my civilian took me to report my arrival. Everything has to be reported to someone or other in Russia, in this case the local registrar, a surly bull-necked brute in a grey tunic, who pored over the papers, eyeing me nastily the while. These Russian civil servants are a bad lot, pompous, stupid, and rude at the best. They come in various grades, each with a military title, so that General or Colonel so-and-so turns out to be someone who neglects the parish sanitation, or keeps inaccurate records of livestock. The brutes even wear medals, and are immensely puffed up, and unless you bribe them lavishly, they will cause you all the trouble they can. I was waiting patiently, being eyed curiously by the officials and officers with whom the municipal hall was packed, and the registrar picked his teeth, scowling, and then launched into a great tirade in Russian. I gather it was addressed against all English men in general, and me in particular. He made it clear to my escort and everyone else that he considered it a gross waste of board and lodging that I should be housed at all. He'd have had me in the salt mines for a stinking foreigner who had defiled the holy soil of Mother Russia, and so forth. Until he got quite worked up, banging his desk and shouting and glaring, so that the noise and talk in the room died away as everyone stopped to listen. It was just Jack in office unpleasantness, and I had no choice but to ignore it. But someone else didn't. One of the officers who'd been standing to one side, chatting, suddenly strolled forward in front of the registrar's table, paused to drop his cigarette and set a foot on it, and then without warning lashed the registrar full across the face with his riding crop. The fellow shrieked and fell back in his chair, flinging up his hands to ward another blow. The officer said something in a soft, icy voice, and the trembling hands came down, revealing the livid whip mark on the coarse, bearded face. There wasn't a sound in the room except for the registrar's whimpering, as the officer leisurely raised his crop again and with the utmost deliberation slashed him across the face a second time, laying the bearded cheek open, while the creature screamed but didn't dare move or protect himself. A third slash sent man and chair over, the officer looking at his whip as though it had been in a gutter, dropped it on the floor and then turned to me. "This offer," says he, and to my amazement he spoke in English, "requires correction. With your permission, I shall reinforce the lesson." He looked at the blubbering, bleeding registrar crawling out of the wreck of his chair and rapped out a string of words in that level, chilly whisper. The stricken man changed course and came wriggling across to my feet, babbling and snuffling at my ankles in a most disgusting fashion, while the officer lit another cigarette and looked on. "He will lick your boots," says he, "and I have told him that if he bleeds on them, I shall have him knouted. You wish to kick him in the face?" As you know, I'm something in the bullying line myself, and given a moment, I dare say I'd have accepted. It isn't every day you have the opportunity. But I was too amazed, aye, and alarmed, too, at the cold, deliberate brutality I'd seen, and the registrar seized the opportunity to scramble away, followed by a shattering kick from my protector. "Scum, but rather wiser scum," says he. "He will not insult a gentleman again. A cigarette, Colonel." And he held out a gold case of those paper abominations I'd tried at Sevastopol but hadn't liked. I let him light one for me. It tasted like dung soaked in treacle. "Captain Count Nicholas Pavlovich Ignatieff," says he in that cold, soft voice, "at your service." And as our eyes met through the cigarette smoke, I thought, hello, this is another of those momentous encounters. You don't have to look at this chap twice to remember him forever. It was the eyes, as it so often is. I thought in that moment of Bismarck and Charity Spring and Akbar Khan. It had been the eyes with them, too. But these fellows were different from anything yet. One was blue, but the other had a divided iris, half blue, half brown, and the oddly fascinating effect of this was that you didn't know where to look, but kept shifting from one to the other. For the rest, he had gingerish, curling hair and a square, masterful face that was no way impaired by a badly broken nose. He looked tough and immensely self-assured. It was in his glance, in the abrupt way he moved, in the slant of the long cigarette between his fingers, in the rakish tilt of his peaked cap, in the immaculate white tunic of the Imperial Guards. He was the kind who knew exactly what was what, where everything was, and precisely who was who, especially himself. He was probably a devil with women, admired by his superiors, hated by his rivals, and abjectly feared by his subordinates. One word summed him up: bastard. "I caught your name in that beast's outburst," says he. He was studying me calmly as a doctor regards a specimen. "You are the officer of Balaklava, I think, going to Staratorsk to be lodged with Colonel Count Penchevchevsky. He already has another English officer under his care." I tried to meet his eye and not keep glancing at the registrar, who had hauled himself up at a nearby table and was shakily trying to staunch his gashed face. No one moved a finger to help him. For some reason, I found my cigarette trembling between my fingers. It was foolish with this outwardly elegant, precise, Not unfriendly young gentleman, doing no more than make civil conversation. But I'd just seen him at work and knew the kind of soulless animal cruelty behind the suave mask. I know my villains, and this Captain Count Ignatieff was a bad one. You could feel the savage strength of the man like an electric wave. "I will not detain you, Colonel," says he, in that same cold murmur. And there was all the immeasurable arrogance of the Russian nobleman in the way he didn't look or beckon for my civilian escort, but simply turned his head the merest fraction, and the fellow came scurrying out of the silent crowd. "We may meet at Staratorsk," says Ignatieff, and with the slightest bow to me he turned away. And my escort was hustling me respectfully out to the telegraph, as though he couldn't get away fast enough. I was all for it. The less time you spend near folk like that, the better. It left me shaken, that little encounter. Some people are just terrible in the true sense of the word. I knew now, I thought, how Tsar Ivan had earned that nickname. It implies something far beyond the lip-licking cruelty of your ordinary torturer. Satan, if there is one, is probably a Russian. No one else could have the necessary soulless brutality. It's just part of life to them. I asked my civilian who Ignatieff was and got an unwilling mumble in reply. Russians don't like to talk about their superiors at any time. It isn't safe. And I gather that Ignatieff was so important and so high-born, mere captain though he was, that you just didn't mention him at all. So I consoled myself that I'd probably seen the last of him. Ha! And took stock of the scenery instead. After a few miles, the bare steppe was giving way to large, well-cultivated fields, with beasts and peasants labouring away. The road improved, and presently on an eminence ahead of us there was a great rambling timbered mansion with double wings and extensive outbuildings, all walled and gated, and the thin smoke of a village just visible beyond. We bowled up a fine gravel drive between well-kept lawns with willow trees on their borders, past the arched entrance of a large courtyard, and on to a broad carriage sweep before the house, where a pretty white fountain played. Well, thinks I, cheering up a bit, this will do. Civilization in the midst of barbarism, and very fine too. Pleasant grounds, genteel accommodation, salubrious outlook. Company's own water, no doubt, to suit overworked military man in need of rest and recreation. Flashy, my son. This'll answer admirably until they sign the peace. The only note out of harmony was the Cossack guard lounging near the front steps, to remind me that I was a prisoner after all. A steward emerged, bowing, and my civilian explained that he would conduct me to my apartment, and thereafter I would doubtless meet Count Pentrajevsky. I was led into a cool, light-panelled hall, and if anything was needed to restore my flagging spirits, it was the fine furs on the well-polished floor, the comfortable leather furniture, the flowers on the table, the cosy air of civilian peace, and the delightful little blonde who had just descended the stairs. She was so unexpected I must have goggled at her like poor Willie in the presence of his St. John's Wood whore. And she was worth a long stare, about middle height, perhaps 18 or 19, plump bosom, tiny in the waist, with a saucy little upturned nose, pink dimpled cheeks, and a cloud of silvery blonde hair. She was fit to make your mouth water, especially if you hadn't had a woman in 2 months, and had just finished a long, dusty journey through southern Russia. Gaping at misshapen peasants, I stripped, seized, and mounted her in a twinkling of my mind's eye, as she tripped past. I bowing my most military bow, and she disregarding me beyond a quick, startled glance from slanting grey eyes. May it be a long war, thinks I, watching her bouncing out of sight. And then my attention was taken by the major domo, muttering the eternal, Pajalsta, Excellenze, and leading me up the broad, creaky staircase along a turning passage, and finally halting at a broad door. He knocked, and an English voice called, Come in! No, hang it all! Kaditiev! I grinned at the friendly familiar sound and strode in, saying, Hello yourself, whoever you are! And putting out my hand. A man of about my own age, who'd been reading on the bed, looked up in surprise, swung his legs to the ground, stood up, and then sank back on the bed again, gaping as though I were a ghost. He shook his head, stuttering, and then got out, Flashman! Good heavens! I stopped short. The face was familiar somehow. but I didn't know from where. And then the years rolled away, and I saw a boy's face under a tile hat and heard a boy's voice saying, "I'm sorry, Flashman." Yes, it was him, all right. Scud East of Rugby. Chapter 6. For a long moment we just stared at each other, and then we both found our voices in the same phrase. "What on earth are you doing here?" And then we stopped, uncertainly, until I said, "I was captured at Balaclava 3 weeks back.
They took me at Silistria 3 months ago. I've been here 5 weeks and 2 days."
And then we stared at each other some more, and finally I said, "Well, you certainly know how to make a fella at home. Ain't you going to offer me a chair, even?" He jumped up at that, colouring and apologising. Still the same raw scud, I could see. He was taller and thinner than I remembered. His brown hair was receding, too. But he still had that quick, awkward nervousness, I remembered.
"I'm so taken aback," he stuttered, pulling up a chair for me. Why, I'm glad to see you, Flashman. Here, give me your hand, old fellow. There. Well, my, what a mountain of size you've grown, to be sure. You always were a big, tall chap, of course, but... I say, isn't this a queer fix, us meeting again like this after so long? Let's see, it must be 15 years since Arnold kicked me out for being pissy drunk."
He coloured again.
"Oh, I was going to say, since we said goodbye."
"Aye. Well, never mind. What's your rank, Scud? Major, eh?" "I'm a colonel."
"Yes," says he. "I see that."
He gave me an odd, almost shy grin.
"You've done well. Everyone knows about you. All the fellas from Rugby talk about you when one meets them, you know."
"Do they, though? Not with any great love, I'll be bound, eh? Young Scud."
"Oh, come," cries he. "What do you mean? Oh, stuff. We were all boys then, and boys never get on too well, especially when some are bigger and older, and... Why, that's all done with years ago. Why, everyone's proud of you, Flashman. Brooke and Green and young Brooke. He's in the Navy, you know."
He paused.
"The doctor would have been proudest of all, I'm sure."
"Aye, he probably would," thinks I. "The damned old hypocrite.
Everyone knows about Afghanistan and India and all that," he ran on. "I was out there myself, you know, in the Sikh campaign, when you were winning another set of laurels. All I got was a shot wound, a hole in my ribs and a broken arm."
He laughed ruefully.
"Not much to show, I'm afraid. And then I bought out of the 101st, and... But heavens, how I'm rattling on. Oh, it's just good to see you, old fellow. This is the best, most famous thing. Let me have a good look at you. By George, those are some whiskers, though."
I couldn't be sure if he meant it or not. God knows Scud East had no cause to love me, and the sight of him had so taken me back to that last black day at Rugby that I'd momentarily forgotten we were men now, and things had changed. Perhaps even his memories of me, for he did seem pleased to see me, now that he'd got over his surprise. Of course, that could be just acting on his part, or making the best of a bad job, or just Christian decency. I found myself weighing him up. I'd knocked him about a good deal in happier days, and it came as a satisfaction to realise that I could probably still do it now, if it came to the pinch. He was still smaller and thinner than I. At that, I'd never detested him as much as his manly, mealy little pal, Brown. He'd had more game in him than the others had East. And now, well, if he was disposed to be civil and let bygones be bygones, we were bound to be stuck together for some months at least. All this in a second's consideration, and you may think, what a mean and calculating nature, or what a guilty conscience. Never you mind. I know my own nature hasn't changed in 80 years, so why should anyone else's? And I never forget an injury. I've done too many of them. So I didn't quite enter into his joyous spirit of reunion, but was civil enough. And after he'd got over his sham ecstasies at meeting his dear old schoolfellow again, I said, "What about this place, then, and this fellow Pentrajevsky?" He hesitated a moment, glanced towards the wall, got up, and as he walked over to it, said loudly, "Oh, it is, as you see it, a splendid place. They've treated me well, very well indeed." And then he beckoned me to go over beside him, at the same time laying a finger on his lips. I went, wondering, and followed his pointing finger to a curious protuberance in the ornate carving of the panelling beside the stove. It looked as though a small funnel had been sunk into the carving and covered with a fine metal grill, painted to match the surrounding wood.
"I say, old fellow," says East, "what do you say to a walk? The Count has splendid gardens, and we are free of them, you know. I took the hint, and we descended the stairs to the hall, and out onto the lawns. The lounging Cossack looked at us, but made no move to follow. As soon as we were at a safe distance, I asked, "What on earth was it?"
"Speaking tube, carefully concealed," says he.
"I looked out for it as soon as I arrived. There's one in the next room, too, where you'll be. I fancy our Russian hosts like to be certain we're not up to mischief."
"Well, I'm damned. The deceitful brutes. Is that any way to treat gentlemen? And how the deuce did you know how to look for it?"
"Oh, just caution," says he offhand. But then he thought for a moment and went on. "I know a little about such things, you see. When I was taken at Silistria, although I was officially with the Bashi Bazouk people, I was more on the political side, really. I think the Russians know it, too. When they brought me up this way, I was most carefully examined at first by some very shrewd gentlemen from their staff. I speak some Russian, you see. Oh, yes, my mother's family married in this direction a few generations ago, and we had a sort of great-aunt who taught me enough to whet my interest. Anyway, on top of their suspicions of me, that accomplishment is enough to make them pay very close heed to H. East, Esquire."
"Well, it's an accomplishment you can pass on to me as fast as you like," says I.
"But you mean they think you're a spy?" "Oh, no, just worth watching and listening to. They're the most suspicious folk in the world, you know. Trust no one, not even each other. And for all they're supposed to be thick-headed barbarians, they have some clever jokers among them."
Something made me ask, "Do you know a chap called Ignatieff, Count Ignatieff?"
"Do I not?" says he. "He was one of the fellows who ran the rule over me when I came up here. That's Captain Swing with blue blood, that one. Why, do you know him?"
I told him what had happened earlier in the day, and he whistled.
"He was there to have a look and a word with you, you may depend on it. We must watch what we say, Flashman. Not that our consciences aren't clear, but we may have some information that will be useful to them." He glanced about. "And we won't feed their suspicions by talking too much where they can't hear us. Another 5 minutes and we'd better get back to the room. If we want to be private there, at any time, we'll hang a coat over their confounded tube. You may believe me, that works. But before we go, and I'll tell you as quickly as I may, those things that are better said in the open air."
It struck me he was a cool, assured hand, this East. Of course, he had been all that as a boy, too.
"Count Pentrajevsky, an ogre, loud-mouthed, brutal, and a tyrant. He's a Cossack who rose to command a hussar regiment in the army, won the Tsar's special favour and retired here, away from his own tribal land. He rules his estate like a despot, treats his serfs abominably, and will surely have his throat cut one day. I can't abide him and keep out of his way, although I sometimes dine with the family for appearance's sake. But he's been decent enough, I'll admit. Gives me the run of the place, a horse to ride, that sort of thing."
"Ain't they worried you might ride for it?" says I.
"Where to? We're 200 miles north of the Crimea here, with nothing but naked country in between. Besides, the Count has a dozen or so of his old Cossacks in his service. They're all the guard anyone needs. Kubans, who could ride down anything on four legs. I saw them bring back 4 serfs who ran away soon after I got here. They'd succeeded in travelling 20 miles before the Cossacks caught them. Those devils brought them back tied by the ankles and dragged behind their ponies the whole way." He shuddered. "They were flayed to death in the first few miles."
I felt my stomach give one of its little heaves.
"But anyway, those were serfs," says I. "They wouldn't do that sort of thing to...
Wouldn't they, though?" says he.
"Well, perhaps not. But this ain't England, you know, or France, or even India. This is Russia, and these landowners are no more accountable than a baron in the Middle Ages. Oh, I dare say he'd think twice about mishandling us. Still, I'd think twice about getting on his wrong side. But I say, I think we'd best go back and treat him to some harmless conversation, if anyone's bothering to listen."
As we strolled back, I asked him a question which had been exercising me somewhat. "Who's the fair beauty I saw when I arrived?" He went red as a poppy, and I thought, "Oh, what have we here, eh? Young scud with lecherous notions, or pure Christian passion? I wonder which."
"That would be Valentina," says he, "the Count's daughter. She and her aunt Sarah, and an old deaf woman who is a cousin of sorts, are his only family. He's a widower." He cleared his throat nervously. "One sees very little of them, though. As I said, I seldom dine with the family. Valentina, is married.
I found this vastly amusing. It was my guess that young Scud had gone wild about the little bundle. Small blame to him. And like the holy little humbug he was, preferred to avoid her rather than court temptation. One of Arnold's shining young knights, he was. Well, lusty old Sir Lancelot Flashy had galloped into the lists now. Too bad she had a husband, of course, but at least she'd be saddle-broken. At that, I'd have to see what her father was like and how the land lay generally. One has to be careful about these things. I met the family at dinner that afternoon, and a most fascinating occasion it turned out to be. Pentruchevsky was worth travelling a long way to see in himself. The first sight of him standing at his table head justified East's description of ogre and made me think of Jack and the Beanstalk and smelling the blood of Englishmen, which was an unhappy notion when you considered it. He must have been well over 6.5 feet tall, and even so he was broad enough to appear squat. His head and face were just a mass of brown hair trained to his shoulders, and in a splendid beard that rippled down his chest. His eyes were fine under huge shaggy brows, and the voice that came out of the beard was one of your thunderous Russian basses. He spoke French well, by the way, and you'd never have guessed from the glossy colour of his hair and the ease with which he moved his huge bulk that he was over 60. An enormous man in every sense, not least in his welcome. "The Colonel Flashman," he boomed, "be happy in this house. As an enemy, I say forget the quarrel for a season. As a soldier, I say welcome, brother." He shook my hand in what was probably only the top joints of his enormous fingers and crushed it till it cracked. "Aye, you look like a soldier, sir. I am told you fought in a disgraceful affair at Balaclava, where our cavalry were chased like the rabble they are. I salute you and every good sabre who rode with you. Chased like rabbits, those toots and moujiks on horseback." "Toots are renegades." "Aye, you would not have chased my Kubans so, or Wittgenstein's hussars when I had command of them. No, by the great God." He glowered down at me, rumbling, as though he would break into fee-fi-fo-fum at any moment, and then released my hand and waved towards the two women seated at the table. "My daughter, Valla. My sister-in-law, Madame Sarah." I bowed, and they inclined their heads and looked at me with that bold, appraising stare which Russian women use. They're not bashful or missish, those ladies. Valentina, or Valla, as her father called her, smiled and tossed her silver blonde head. She was a plumply pert little piece, sure enough. But I spared a glance for Aunt Sarah as well. She'd be a few years older than I, about 35, perhaps, with dark, close-bound hair, and one of those strong, masterful, chiselled faces. Handsome, but not beautiful. She'd have a moustache in a few years, but she was well-built and tall, carrying her bounties before her. For all that Pentruchevsky looked like Goliath, he had good taste, or whoever ordered his table and domestic arrangements had. The big dining room, like all the apartments in the house, had a beautiful wood-tiled floor. There was a chandelier and any amount of brocade and flowered silk about the furnishings. Pentruchevsky himself, by the way, was dressed in silk. Most Russian gentlemen wear formal clothes as we do, more or less, but he affected a magnificent shimmering green tunic, clasped at the waist by a silver-buckled belt, and silk trousers of the same colour tucked into soft leather boots. A most striking costume, and comfortable too, I should imagine. The food was good, to my relief, a fine soup being followed by fried fish, a ragu of beef, and side dishes of poultry and game of every variety, with little sweet cakes and excellent coffee. The wine was indifferent, but drinkable. Between the victuals, the four fine bosoms displayed across the table, and Pentruchevsky's conversation, it was a most enjoyable meal. He questioned me about Balaclava most minutely, and when I'd satisfied his curiosity, astonished me by rapidly sketching how the Russian cavalry should have been handled, with the aid of cutlery, which he clashed about on the table to demonstrate. He knew his business, no doubt of it, but he was full of admiration for our behaviour, and Scarlet's particularly. "Great God, there is an English Cossack," says he. "Uphill, eh? I like him. I like him. Let him be captured, dear lord, and sent to Staratorsk, so that I can keep him forever and talk. and fight all battles and shout at each other like good companions.
And get drunk nightly and be carried to bed,
says Miss Fella pertly. They enter into talk with the men, you know, these Russian ladies, with a freedom that would horrify our own polite society. And they drink, too. I noticed that both of them went glass for glass with us, without becoming more than a trifle merry.
That, too, Golobashka, says Penchajevsky. Can he drink, then, this scarlet? Of course he must. All good horse soldiers can, eh, Colonel? Not like your Sasha, though, says he to Vala with a great wink at me. Can you imagine, Colonel, I have a son-in-law who cannot drink? He fell down at his wedding on this very floor. Yes, over there, by God. After what? A glass or two of vodka. St. Nicholas. Ay, me. How I must have offended the Father God to have a son-in-law who cannot drink. And does not get me grandchildren. At this, Vala gave a most unladylike snort and tossed her head, and Aunt Sara, who said very little as a rule, I discovered, set down her glass and observed tartly that Sasha could hardly get children while he was away fighting in the Crimea. Fighting! Cries Penchajevsky boisterously. Fighting in the horse artillery! Who ever saw one of them coming home on a stretcher? I would have had him in the Bug Lancers, or even the Moscow Dragoons, but, body of St. Sophia, he doesn't ride well. A fine son-in-law for a Zaporozhian hetman, that.
A hetman is a leader.
Well, dear father, snaps Vala, if he had ridden well and been in the Lancers or the Dragoons, it is odds the English cavalry would have cut him into little pieces, since you were not there to direct operations.
Small loss that would have been,
grumbles he, and then leaned over laughing and rumpled her blonde hair.
There, little one, he is your man, such as he is. God sent him safe home.
I tell you all this to give you some notion of a Russian country gentleman at home with his family, although I'll own that a Cossack may not be typical. No doubt he wasn't to East's delicate stomach, and I gather he didn't care for East too much either. But I found myself liking Penchajevsky. He was gross, loud, boisterous, boorish, if you like, but he was worth 10 of your proper gentlemen, to me at any rate. I got roaring drunk with him that evening, after the ladies had retired. They were fairly tipsy themselves and arguing at the tops of their voices about dresses as they withdrew to their drawing-room. And he sung Russian hunting songs in that glorious organ voice and laughed himself sick trying to learn the words of the British Grenadiers. I flatter myself he took to me enormously. Folk often do, of course, particularly the coarser spirits. For he swore I was a credit to my regiment and my country and God should send the Tsar a few like me.
Then we should sweep you English bastards into the sea, he roared. A few of your scarlets and flashmans and caragans, that is the name, no? That is all we need.
But drunk as he was, when he finally rose from the table, he was careful to turn in the direction of the church and cross himself devoutly, before stumbling to guide me up the stairs. I was to see a different side to Penchajevsky, and to all of them, for that matter, in the winter that followed. But for the first few weeks of my sojourn at Staratorsk, I thoroughly enjoyed myself, and felt absolutely at home. It was so much better than I'd expected. The Count was so amiable in his bear-like, thundering way. His ladies were civil, for I decided to go warily before attempting a more intimate acquaintance with Vala, and easy with me. And East and I were allowed such freedom that it was like a month of weekends at an English country house without any of the stuff in it. You could come and go as you please, treat the place as your own, attend at mealtimes or feed in your chamber, whichever suited. It was Liberty Hall, no error. I divided my days between working really hard at my Russian, going for walks or rides with Vala and Sara, or East, prosing with the Count in the evenings, playing cards with the family. They have a form of whist called Biritch, which has caught on in England this last few years,
and we played that most evenings, and generally taking life easy. My interest in Russian they found especially flattering, for they are immensely proud and sensitive about their country, and I made even better progress than usual. I soon spoke and understood it better than East.
"He has a Cossack somewhere in his family," Pentrajevsky would bawl. "Let him add a beard to those foolish English whiskers, and he can ride with the Cubans, eh, Colonel?"
All mighty pleasant until you discovered that the civility and good nature were no deeper than a May frost, the thin covering on totally alien beings. For all their apparent civilization and even good taste, the barbarian was just under the surface and liable to come raging out. It was easy to forget this until some word or incident reminded you that this pleasant house and estate were like a medieval castle under feudal law, that this jovial, hospitable giant, who talked so knowledgeably of cavalry tactics in the hunting field and played chess like a master, was also as dangerous and cruel as a cannibal chief. That his ladies, chattering cheerfully about French dressmaking or flower arrangement, were in some respects rather less feminine than Dahomey Amazons. One such incident I'll never forget. There was an evening when the four of us were in the salon, Pentrajevsky and I playing chess. He had handicapped himself by starting without queen or castle to make a game of it. And the women at some two-handed game of cards across the room. Aunt Sarah was quiet as usual, and Vala prattled gaily and squeaking with vexation when she lost. I wasn't paying much attention, for I was happy with the Count's brandy, and looked like beating him for once too. But when I heard them talking about settling the wager, I glanced across and almost fell from my chair. Vala's maid and the housekeeper had come into the room. The maid, a serf girl, was kneeling by the card table, and the housekeeper was carefully shearing off her long red hair with a pair of scissors. Aunt Sarah was watching idly. Vala wasn't even noticing until the housekeeper handed her the tresses.
"Ah, how pretty," says she,
and shrugged and tossed them over to Aunt Sarah, who stroked them, and said,
"Shall I keep them for a wig or sell them?"
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.